Welcome to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. The South Dakota primary is less than a week away. Governor Dennis Dugard weighs the viability of a special session for the state legislature to discuss Medicaid expansion. The Dakota political junkies are here to make sense of it all. Today, we welcome Denise Ross. She's an editor at Black Hills Knowledge Network and South Dakota Dashboard. Denise, welcome back to Dakota Midday.
Great to be here, Lori. Thank you.
We are also joined by Jonathan Ellis. He's a reporter and columnist with the Sioux Falls Argus Leader. Jonathan, thanks for being here as well.
Hey, fun times, Lori. Fun times.
let's start with those state primaries. Before we get to the presidential implications, let's talk local. Denise, you want to start west of the river because you have some pretty intriguing matchups.
Well, probably the most interesting one on the list is the one where Senator Phil Jensen, who is as far to the right as any state legislator that I'm aware of, was called out in a mailer for being a conscientious objector during the Vietnam era when he lived in Kansas, and it had a picture of his draft card with the conscientious objector status on that. And it's too bad Seth Tupper isn't with us today, but I did get to talk to him a little bit when he was working on the story right after he had called up Senator Jensen, whose response was, "That's insane," to which Seth said, "That's not really a denial," you know. And then Senator Jensen didn't want to talk anymore and wanted the rest of the questions to be done in writing, which is all in the story that was published in the Rapid City Journal that Seth wrote. So I think that caught him. I think it's fair to say that caught Senator Jensen by surprise that this information was out there. It was mailed to people in his district. Of course, he's being challenged by Jackie Sly, who was in the House and has been term limited out, but she was sort of at the tip of the spear of this education bill and teacher pay bill that passed, worked on the Blue Ribbon Task Force. I watched her in the Cracker Barrels here out in Rapid City stand up week after week and argue in favor of the provisions of that bill and explain it. And it's clear there's a division within the Republican Party legislators, and I think you're going to see this race as much as any, you know, define that division, and we'll see where the voters come out next week.
So in Seth Tupper's piece, and I do recommend that listeners find it at therapidcityjournal.com, he kind of laid out what information was given to them, and then they did a request, Freedom of Information Act or some other open rules policy. I'm going to forget what it's called right now. I'm sorry to say, requesting the information from the government. So, have you heard the results of? I guess my question is: was he in fact a draft dodger? Was he a conscientious objector?
Well, I haven't talked to Seth since the story's been published, but I can tell you with those Freedom of Information Act requests, which is most likely what it would have been, those can take some time. So we may not. I would be surprised if we heard back before next week's election.
They had an image of his draft card that said the distinction right on it.
And if you read the story, I mean, Senator Denton doesn't come out and say that's false, that's not true, or whatnot. He tries to explain it. So I don't think the veracity of that document is in too much question,
sure.
But it's good for the newspaper to go and actually get the actual record and not just rely on the political opponents to...
Interesting timing. Are you hearing a fallout from that for Jensen?
A little bit, mostly from Senator Jensen detractors who are getting a certain amount of enjoyment out of it. I'm sure Senator Jensen is not. And we'll just have to see, you know, in this year of all years, and we know what's happening at the presidential level, voters, I don't know if you can predict their reaction to certain things. If they've decided they like Senator Jensen for his position on issues, or they're mad at Jackie Sly because they don't like the teacher pay bill that passed, I think that's going to probably have more to do with how things turn out next week, but we will just have to wait and see.
Jonathan, let's go East River for a minute and tell me about some of the marquee matchups on your side of the state.
Well, I would say that the blood and guts are really over on the West River, and you know, we've been enjoying it all the way out here. Just some of the stuff that's taking place, whether it's in District 34 or whatever. I mean, it's some pretty good stuff. But over here, I mean, we have I think one primary here is with Senator Deb Peters. She's looking for a fourth term in the Senate, and she faces Laura Hubbell, who is a former state legislator who had served a couple terms ago. So that's an interesting challenge close to here. I mean, Laura Hubbell is Sioux Falls, and Deb Peters is in Hartford. You know, another decent one, I think, on this side of the state is with Larry Tiedemann, again, in Brookings, who's also looking, you know, I think he's also looking for a fourth term against Doug Post. And I think that race is framed much like probably some of the races on West River are, in that I think Post is, you know, running to the right of Larry Tiedemann, opposed to the fact that, you know, he supported various policies which conservatives opposed, such as teacher pay, things like that. And there's also a strong element of in both the Peters and Tiedemann races, there's a strong element of abortion politics. But frankly, interestingly enough, perhaps the most interesting legislative primary we do have is actually between a couple Democrats. And that's in District 15, which is in Sioux Falls, sort of the north end of Sioux Falls, has always been a very reliable Democratic district, a lot of working class Catholic Democrats in that district. So one of the few areas where in the state where Democrats are typically safe. And in that race, we have, well, Angie Buell, who is retiring after three terms. We have Patrick Kirschman, who has been in the House. He's running for the Senate seat. And then he's also being challenged then by Reynold Nesiba, who is an Augustana University economics professor. And so that's really an interesting race, and it really, in my view, highlights the divide that the Democratic Party faces in this state. I think, you know, you look at Nesiba and say he's kind of represents sort of the progressive social side of the Democratic Party, whereas Kirschman is sort of the old school labor wing of the party, and they don't always see eye to eye. Especially on abortion politics. Within that District 15, you'd find a lot of pro-life Democrats. So it's going to be an interesting race. That one was much. That this race now is a lot like one in about 6 years ago, in which Kathy Miles, an established state senator, lost to Angie Buell. Again, Kathy Miles had that strong pro-life Catholic bloc supporting her. So this will be kind of a really, you know, on our side of the state, it'll be fun to see how this one plays out.
Interesting. Denise, you want to expand beyond the Sly Jensen to another race out there that is particularly interesting to watch?
Well, we have another interesting matchup between, where we've got retiring Senator Craig Teason, who had been a Rapid City police chief, and I think it's fair to call him a moderate Republican. And he's being, Jeff Partridge, who's now in the House, is seeking to replace him. I think it's fair to say Jeff is to the right of Craig Teason. Then you've got another candidate even further to the right, also trying to switch chambers. You got, I'm going to get this wrong. Jonathan, help me out.
McIntyre?
McIntyre. I wanted to say Lance Russell, and I know that's not right because he's from Hot Springs. So that, yeah, we've got McIntyre, who I don't know a lot about other than I just heard her ad on the radio just before you called me up. And she should not be flip-flopping on issues, and so I think that's a signal to people who want their legislators to stand firm on issues and not follow the governor's agenda or anybody else's, but the right-wing agenda. And so, you know, I think we identify people by R's and D's in print when we write about politics in this state. I think we need some other kind of label in the Republican Party because you're getting them. The people who are further to the right are.
Oh, we're losing Denise. We lost you just a little bit there, Denise.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yep. Better.
The people who are far to the right within the Republican Party are getting higher in numbers, better organized, and better funded. And so I think, you know, we've got an interesting dynamic here in the state when you've got, you know, the Republicans dominating. I think it's only natural that then that big of a party is going to fracture into these different components. So we're definitely seeing that happen.
And Jonathan, the governor is participating in this through some financial contributions. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
I haven't followed that too closely. I know the governor certainly has his preferred candidates in this race, and some of them are not the ones that Denise was just talking about. But you would see, like, for example, West River races, Alan Solano, who's a Senate in District 32, was appointed by Governor Dugard. And again, you would say that Solano is probably going to be one of the more moderate Democrats, or sorry, Republicans, who would support, and we're going to talk about this in a little bit, but probably, I don't know this firsthand, but probably would support, I'm guessing, the governor's proposal to expand Medicaid, things like that. So certainly the governor has his preferred candidates in these races, and you know, what we're seeing is a little bit of cannibalism here going on, which is, you know, from a political reporter's perspective, it's fun to watch.
It's job security for you, Jonathan.
Right? Correct.
Denise, any last words on campaign contributions before we talk about the presidential primary?
No, I do think those are the, if you really want to know where the political tide is heading, I think you watch those political contributions and see where the PAC money is going, where the governor's money is going, and you can pretty much determine where the battle lines are within those Republican party groups there, yeah.
So Senator John Thune sums up how the Republicans maybe feel about Donald Trump. He gives an endorsement, not necessarily a ringing endorsement, but an endorsement nonetheless. Jonathan, do you want to talk about Thune and the state GOP and their relationship with the presumptive nominee?
I think that's an evolving relationship. I mean, I think that, as you indicated, I think that they're trying to warm up to the nominee, and it'll be interesting because we still have, in theory, the voters still have an opportunity to pick Donald Trump or John Kasich is on the ballot, as is Ted Cruz, and I always thought that Ted Cruz was sort of the favorite before he dropped out of the race. I frankly wouldn't be surprised if Ted Cruz won on Tuesday, even if just a lot of Republicans want to come out and protest vote on Donald Trump. I think that, I mean, you know, what Thune said is that, you know, that Donald Trump is going to be sort of the person who brings change to Washington. And I don't think anybody's disputing that. You know, nobody I hear is disputing that. And that comes with a lot of change, frankly, to the establishment Republicans, which have been camped out in Washington and Arlington, Virginia, and all these places basically since the days of Reagan. And there hasn't been a lot of change to the Republican Party itself, and Donald Trump potentially represents that. And I don't know that at the end of the day, for a guy like John Thune, who's and a lot of other Republicans, that's a place they necessarily want to go. But as you can see from, you know, what he's talked about, I mean, it's from the Republican perspective, it's better than Hillary Clinton.
Denise, you want to talk a little bit about that too?
Yes.
Weigh in on whether or not South Dakota will go big for Trump and show their support?
You know, I really don't know. I think Johnson's onto something. Ted Cruz may make a very strong showing next week. But what most interested me about that was, if you parse Thune's statement, he says, "I intend to endorse the nominee." And it looks like Donald Trump could be your nominee. Well, we still have a convention to go through, and there's a lot of machinations going on behind the scene, and I'm picking up on that just by watching the cable news networks for a half an hour a day here and there. And so, you know, the reporter in me is thinking, what are they up to? What could be going on behind the scenes, and what tricks might these establishment Republicans who cannot stomach Donald Trump, what might they be planning for the convention? So I think we need to keep our eye on that. And you know, the fat lady has not yet quite sung.
It's
warming up. But
it's not over yet.
So I think we need to be aware of that. And Thune is definitely plugged into all of the national level stuff that's going on. The other thing, though, when he spoke to the Lincoln Day crowd in Sioux Falls, and he said, you know, he said nice things about Donald Trump, and I think that's a sign that if John Thune is getting in line with Donald Trump, that's a sign that that on the flip side of the coin of what I was just talking about, there's a certain amount of resignation and acceptance going on that they need to do what they can to salvage what's left in their mind of this election cycle. They don't love Donald Trump, but they're going to make the best of it, and if Thune is doing that, you can bet that's a sign that everybody else is too.
Speaking of not over yet, how important, Jonathan, is the Tuesday primary day for Hillary Clinton?
Well, I think much like in 2008, you know, Hillary Clinton went into the race, and I think it was a big symbolic victory for her. I think that the same could probably be said for Bernie Sanders. Most people have said, "Hey, he can't win." But you know, to finish out strong with the hope that maybe you can switch some superdelegates. So for both candidates, I think it's an important race. I really wouldn't be surprised if we don't see some visits ahead of, last-minute visits ahead of the Tuesday primaries, maybe even from both candidates. Maybe, you know, I mean, I think Hillary Clinton is focusing maybe more on the general election now, but it wouldn't shock me if they were to show up. You know, obviously California is sort of the big race that day, that sort of overshadows everything, but you also have Montana here, so... you know, it's possible that you could schedule a quick trip up here. Hillary Clinton has been faltering, and she would want to. I think she wants to finish strong. Obviously, California is the big gem, but you know, if you can say you had a good night on Tuesday, and that included winning South Dakota. I mean, those are bragging rights there.
Any polling numbers coming out yet from South Dakota, Denise?
You know, none that I have seen. And I'm not aware of any. That would be a very interesting poll to check out.
I think Tuesday will be an interesting day. Denise, let's talk a little bit about Medicaid expansion and the potential for a special session. Sum that up for us.
Well, reading the press reports, Governor Dugard says that he's figured out a way to expand Medicaid without expanding state spending by saving in other areas, primarily negotiating with the Federal Indian Health Service to base, you know, and this is something that John Thune is talking about at the federal level, fulfilling some of their treaty rights by providing health care and paying for some of this health care for the Native Americans who are enrolled in tribes. So this is something that South Dakota governors have been trying to do for decades. The fact that he's been able to do that, I think, is quite noteworthy. And if Dennis Dugard, who I've said before, is a penny pincher, if he says he can do this without expanding state spending, I tend to believe that. You know, we'll have to see the numbers, but I think if he says that he can do it, I think he can count on that. And so then the next question is going to be, can he convince enough state legislators to vote for it in a special session? I think it's telling that he wants to do it now before the fall election and we get a new crop of state legislators. He wants to do it this summer. And so he's counting votes, and basically what he said was he's not going to do the special session if there's a chance this won't pass. So if there is a special session, they've got their votes lined up ahead of time, and they've got a predetermined outcome, it sounds to me.
Jonathan, any scuttlebutt on that, if you will? Have you been hearing that it's a possibility, politically viable?
Based on what the Associated Press put out, yeah. Now, is it politically viable? I mean, there are a number of Republicans who are simply just incredulous that Indian Health Services or the federal government are going to keep their word on this issue, and so they think that this is sort of a bait and switch to get the state to expand the program. Mm-hmm. So there, you'll have a lot of them who just absolutely, you know, don't believe that, and frankly, a lot of them who are just simply opposed to the program as it is, because it's a large welfare program that mm-hmm. Republicans generally just don't support. So there'll be a significant block of opposition, but I think Denise is right. I mean, if the governor does go ahead and call the special election in an election year, before an election, you could bet that he feels pretty confident that he would have enough votes to get it done.
And Jonathan, let's finish up with a little bit on treaty rights. You wrote a column about the sort of the complexity of honoring treaty obligations. You want to sum that up?
Well, you know, candidates have talked about it, and Bernie Sanders did, and it's a lot more complex than just saying that. These treaties were written, you know, in particular, the one that we are interested in, the Laramie Treaty of 1868. So many things were written into the treaty that just are certainly obsolete today. And then are you talking about treaty rights? That would essentially mean evicting, non-tribal residents west of the Missouri River. I mean, it's very complex to talk about treaty rights. And so even the health care issue, the health care issue within the 1868 Laramie Treaty called for the U.S. to provide a doctor for at least 10 years. Well, I mean, you know, it's just very complex. It's one thing for politicians to talk about treaty rights. It's another thing to actually go into the guts of what the treaty actually said.
It makes a good stump speech, though.
It does. It does.
Jonathan Ellis is a columnist and reporter for the Argus Leader. Jonathan, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Lori.
And Denise Ross, editor of Black Hills Knowledge Network and South Dakota Dashboard. Denise, thanks for being here as well.
It's always great to join you.